Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. Today is the 4th of July, 2014, so happy Independence Day to my American listeners. And for the rest of you, well, happy July 4th. And let's introduce today's guest. Today we're going to be talking to Kathy Manley. She is a criminal defense attorney as well as the legal director of the National Coalition to Protect Civil Freedoms. She's a founder of Project Salaam and vice president of the Capital Region Chapter of the New York Civil Liberties Union. And somehow, amongst all of those responsibilities, she has also recently found the time to co-author a study with Stephen Downs entitled Inventing Terrorists, The Lawfare of Preemptive Prosecution, an intriguing title. And we will be discussing that study today, which, of course, will be linked up in the show notes for today's episode at CorbettReport.com. So, Kathy Manley, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's start in on this discussion, and of course I want to talk about that very intriguing title, The Lawfare of Preemptive Prosecution, but perhaps before we get into that, it is your first time on the program, maybe you can just introduce yourself for the audience and tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Sure, I'm a criminal defense attorney in Albany, New York, which is upstate, you know, 3 hours north of New York City, and we became involved, myself and Stephen Downs, in these issues when we were helping to represent a man named Yassin Arif in Albany, who's the imam of a local mosque, a Kurdish refugee from Iraq. And he was entrapped in a very, very unfair sting operation back in 2003-2004. His trial was in 2006. And we thought he would be acquitted, although we understood that there was a huge climate of fear and prejudice against Muslims after 9/11, but there was really no evidence against him. He was, I don't want to go into that whole case, but basically it was very shocking to us to see how the government was able to convict him basically without any evidence, using a lot of secret evidence that they gave to the judge. And we started... after that, he got convicted. He got sentenced to 15 years, he and his co-defendant. We started kind of looking at other similar cases. At first, we thought this was an anomaly, and then we realized that, no, there's actually a lot of other cases out there that are very unfair where Muslims were targeted. And we developed this idea of, well, really, it's the government's idea, but we started analyzing what we call preemptive prosecution, which was a government strategy developed after 9/11 to target and prosecute people, basically Muslims, whose beliefs, not anything they're doing, but their beliefs, raised security concerns for the United States government. And so then they would try to go after them using various tactics, such as sting operations and some other types of charges, which I'll talk about in a little while.
Well, you did, of course, bring up the idea of preemptive prosecution, which, although it should be unthinkable, unfortunately probably is not to a lot of the audience out there who have heard of ideas like this in recent years, especially, of course, since 9/11. But how about the other operative term in that title, the lawfare of preemptive prosecution? What is lawfare?
Right. Well, lawfare, it actually comes from a blog that some national security lawyers created, and we thought, okay, that makes sense because what's going on here is really part of the war that the United States, the wars that the United States is involved in basically in Muslim countries. So obviously Afghanistan, Iraq, and now, you know, a lot of other places where they're using drone attacks. And this is sort of part of that. It's basically where they want to go after certain people because of these national security concerns. Sometimes if they're abroad, they'll drop a missile on them with a drone. If they're in the United States, they'll go after them using preemptive prosecution. So you have to understand that context.
Well, that is a very worrying concept, because I think every time we've ever seen a regime trying to use law in a warfare setting, it's generally not for the good, and perhaps no exception here. Excuse me. So let's get
right
into the
deep... Even, yeah. Justice Scalia even said something like, in times of war, the law goes out the window. I don't forget the exact quote, but he wasn't applying it to these cases, unfortunately.
No.
But it's very true in general, and it's very true here.
Absolutely right. Well, as I say, of course, this this study that you've worked on, Inventing Terrorists, does go into this in some degree of detail, and it uses as a launching point a DOJ list of terrorism and terrorist-related convictions from 2001 to 2010. And does some statistical analyses and other things on it. Tell us about this study and the methodology that you used.
Yes, sure. So we noticed that the Department of Justice was trumpeting the fact that they had apparently prosecuted 400 terrorists in the United States successfully. And I have to say that the reason they were doing this was kind of a good reason, in that they were using it to try to justify closing Guantanamo, which of course should be closed. However, we thought, wait a minute, 400 terrorists in the United States, who are those people? Does that include Yasin Arif? And of course we saw that, yes, his name was on there, and we knew that he's not actually a terrorist. And so we thought, I wonder about these other cases on this list. And we discovered that most of them were not terrorists in any way and actually hadn't committed any real crime. Only four of those 400 people had been involved in actual attacks of violence or even attempted violence against people in the United States without the involvement of a government provocateur. And only another nine were involved in those types of activities in other places. So only 13 out of the 400 were actually involved in attacks of violence or even attempted violence. The rest, it wasn't, it was either sting operations, vague material support charges. I'll talk about all that. But basically, we went through all the cases and we looked for these signs of preemptive prosecution. Meaning by preemptive prosecution, I gave you the definition earlier where they're targeted for their beliefs, but you can kind of tell it's a preemptive prosecution case if there's no real crime committed. It's either a sting operation or there's material support for terrorism charges, but no actual crime going on, in the sense that they have no intent to support terrorism. There's no evidence of that. There's nobody hurt, nobody killed, obviously, no property destroyed, nothing stolen, nothing that we would think of as real crime. And a total of 74% of the 400 cases were what we would call pure preemptive prosecution, where there was not really any real crime going on. I'll talk about the different kinds of charges that they used in a little while. Another 20% of those cases had what we call elements of preemptive prosecution, which is to say that there was some crime going on, generally fraud-related crime, some kind of scheme to defraud people over the internet or in some way, or maybe drug crimes, but not terrorist-related crime. But because the people were Muslim, and for whatever other reasons the government was suspicious of their beliefs, they enhanced their sentences. They tried to inject elements of terrorism into these cases. And so we call those elements of preemptive prosecution. And if you add those in to the pure preemptive prosecution cases, it adds up to a total of 94% of the cases that they claim are terrorists aren't really terrorists at all. Some of them may have the desire to be in the future, but who knows? So I could talk a little bit about charges.
Let's clarify that then, because it sounds like what you're saying is that of this 400 plus people on this DOJ list, there was only about 14 that actually are legitimate, justifiable national security concerns in the terrorism arena.
Yeah, and actually only four of those within the United States. I mean, many of the other nine, I mean, not that it matters, it's a very small number, had no interest in attacking the United States. They might have been involved in There was a guy who had tried to do a coup in Cambodia, for example. It had nothing to do with United States direct interests. But yes, they were actually, you know, committing some acts of violence or trying to. That's only 13 out of the whole list of 400.
Well, again, I mean, that's a staggering figure, but again, probably not surprising to people who've been following some of the Corbett reports reporting on this issue. Specifically, we've reported quite a bit in the past on these FBI cases in which the FBI informants seem to actually foment the plots that the FBI then gets the credit for busting. And we've seen that many, many times. And there are many, many different examples of that that we can point to. But what are some of the other examples of ways in which this preemptive prosecution takes place?
Okay, well, sting operations, as you, I won't go into that since you seem already familiar with it in your audience, but that was 21% of the cases. So another huge charge that's often used and is used in sting operations sometimes, these statistics overlap, is the material support for terrorism charge. So in 33% of the 400 cases, or 33% of the actually of the cases that are preemptive prosecution or elements, the government used a material support for terrorism charge. And the problem with that charge is that it doesn't require any intent to actually support terrorism. It doesn't. All you're doing is helping in some way somebody who's associated with a designated terrorist organization. So we've had people who were convicted for donating old clothes to refugee camps in Somalia, where some of those clothes ended up with members of Al-Shabaab, which is a designated organization. So the there was a lawsuit filed back in the 90s when this charge first started to be used, challenging. It was actually brought by a couple of groups who were trying to help bring about peaceful resolution of conflict in Kurdistan, I believe, and the Tamil Tiger situation. Anyway, so this case went all the way up to the Supreme Court because people who were trying to help negotiate for peace between different warring groups were not allowed to do that under this law because they would be considered to be giving material support to whichever side of that group maybe a designated terrorist organization, whichever side of that conflict, I'm sorry, was considered a designated terrorist organization by the United States. But in 2010, the Supreme Court said that that was perfectly okay, that those people who were trying to bring about peace could be charged with material support. And anybody who has any connection with one of these groups, whether it be to try to, you know, make them stop engaging in violence or to, you know, help people realize that they have legitimate grievances without supporting their, you know, violent acts. Anybody who does anything like that can be guilty of material support for terrorism. And so, you know, you have a huge, it's a very popular charge for the government in these cases. You have a huge number of these cases, sometimes as part of sting operations, sometimes because there's some kind of connection there, even though there's no proof of intent to engage in violence. And one of the most outrageous cases of all of these, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, is the case of the Holy Land Foundation.
As a matter of fact, I'm not. Perhaps you can go into
Okay. This was the largest Muslim charity in the United States, and it raised a lot of money to support not just Muslims, it supported people in need in the United States who weren't Muslim, people in their community that were based in Texas. And a lot of the money did go to Palestine because obviously there's a great need there. And it went to Gaza to through what's called Zakat committees, which are set up by the authorities in Gaza, which at some point happened to be involved with Hamas because Hamas won the election. In any event, they would give a lot of money, had no connection to violence. The government never alleged any connection to violence with any of this money. But because it went through these Zakat committees, the government alleged that the Zakat committees were controlled by Hamas, which the United States has designated as a terrorist organization. And so even though the Red Cross the International Red Cross and the government itself, the United States USAID, had given money and was continuing to give money to these very same SACOT committees. The United States was able to convict, and after two trials, the first trial was a mistrial, was able to convict the directors of this charity of material support for terrorism through giving money to these SACOT committees, because they alleged that, well, you know, the USAID and the Red Cross, they weren't trying to support terrorism because they don't have those kind of ideas. But these guys, you know, they've said some things we don't like, and so they're guilty. And they got convicted, and they got sentenced to 65 years, or that was, it was five of them, and that was about the average sentence, 65 years. And these are older individuals. This is basically a life sentence for them. And these are some of the best people that I know of, and it's one of the most outrageous cases because all they were doing was helping people.
Well, not only is that outrageous, and not only does it really provoke outrage, but I think it should also be a warning for what we see unfolding in this unfolding war on terror, which increasingly uses this very vague, very nebulous idea of material support for terrorism in a lot of different legislation, stripping people of a bunch of different rights. And I don't remember if I'm remembering this correctly, but I seem to recall that Section 1021 of the NDAA 2012, the indefinite detention clause, had something to do with material support for terrorism as one of the possibilities for the application of that clause. I'm not sure if I'm right about that, but...
Well, I believe it had to do with, I don't know if they used the word material support, but, I mean, the word terrorism itself is a huge problem because it's whatever the government defines it to be, because there's lots of violence that the government doesn't consider terrorism, right? So I think it was, if you're in the NDAA, if you're suspected of aiding either Al-Qaeda or associated forces in some way, and what is associated forces? It was similar. I don't remember if they used the word material support in the NDAA, but they haven't really been using the NDAA to indefinitely detain people because they have this domestic system that's already in place that does such a good job of detaining people whose ideas they don't like.
Exactly. Well, so really, I think there's multiple interpretations of your title there, Inventing Terrorists. There's not only the terrorists that seem to be invented during these FBI sting operations, but then they also get to invent terrorists just by changing the definition of the word terrorism and using it as a label that they can apply as they wish. And the more vaguely that this is defined and the more widely it's used, I think the more people are going to start falling in under this net. And I really see a growing use of this in an attempt to codify this into law. As a criminal defense attorney who presumably has devoted your entire career to trying to pursue justice, can you speak to the way that this has changed in recent years, or is this just a development of what we've already seen going on for decades?
Well, I think that there's cycles that come and go in our history where there's this kind of hysteria where certain groups of people are targeted. I mean, we've seen it happen before with the Palmer raids, even going back during World War One. There was this rush to deport radical immigrants, and there was some cases there like Sacco and Vanzetti that were very unfair. And then, of course, the Japanese internment. This is very similar in a way that people on the West Coast who are of Japanese ancestry were actually stuck in internment camps because they were perceived as a security threat. And actually, that was based on false secret evidence, which we're seeing again. I mean, that's one of the big components of this whole thing, is that the government has to use secret evidence because basically there is no real evidence. And so they kind of make it up, and we don't know, we can't challenge it, we can't confront it under the Sixth Amendment because it's secret. And that happened in Yasin Arif's case and many of these cases. And it happened in the Japanese internment case that went to the Supreme Court, the Korematsu case, where the Supreme Court was given secret evidence supposedly showing that the Japanese posed a security threat. The Solicitor General said, well, we can't show you all of it, but this is what it says. And then they actually upheld it. The Supreme Court upheld the detention in Korematsu. And later it turned out that the Solicitor General had actually lied, that the secret evidence showed that the Japanese did not pose a security threat. And this came out years later. And we actually had something similar in our case, although we haven't been able to get anywhere with it yet. In the Yasin Arif case, the secret evidence we learned showed that they believed that Yasin Arif was an Al-Qaeda operative named Mohammed Yasin. And so he wasn't charged with this, and we didn't even know about it till years later. But obviously he could not be this person because this person was killed in 2010. So after that, we said, look, this whole case was based on false secret evidence, and we want a new trial. We want to just dismiss the charges. And they just completely ignored it because of procedural obstacles, which is very, very frustrating, as you might imagine.
Well, I think it is good to keep this in that historical perspective because it reminds us that we're not going through a unique situation and that these types of times of increasing tyranny have been turned back, and they can be again, hopefully. So I think that is important to keep in mind. But let's turn then to the conclusions of your study. Obviously, as you point out in the study, the reasons why these terrorists are being so feverishly invented by the government is obviously outside the bounds of a study like this, so just a statistical survey of the DOJ list. But I'm sure we can all draw some our own conclusions about that. But let's talk about some of your recommendations then for how this preemptive prosecution paradigm can be overturned.
Okay, so yeah, we have a bunch of recommendations that has to do with, well, one is changing that material support law. And there was a bill introduced into Congress that the ACLU was pushing, but it hasn't gone anywhere to change the definition of material support to require that the government prove intent to support violence. And so that's one of them. Let's see. We also want to change the entrapment defense because right now with these sting operations, there is no entrapment defense. The only way you can be entrapped, according to the state of the law right now, is if you actually back out of the plot voluntarily. Once you get coerced into it, if you don't back out, then you're not considered to be entrapped, which is insane, because if you back out, they can't even prosecute you anyway. So you can see from the Newberg case, which you may be familiar with, where the provocateur offered the defendant $250,000 when he was avoiding him, and then finally he said, oh, okay, that's the classic definition of entrapment, and yet, under this definition, that was not entrapment. And so we need to reform the entrapment defense to go back to what it was before this crazy case law developed. There's also conspiracy charges are used to get people by guilt by association. If, there's a case out of Raleigh, North Carolina, where a man we know named Yad Yagi was kind of acquaintances with this family, the Boyd family, and the father of the family, Daniel Boyd, started kind of talking about doing some kind of attacks overseas, but it was pretty vague. But just because these people, just because Yad Yagi and his co-defendant knew them, they were roped into this. Because they went on a trip, and there was some talks between them, even though there was no evidence that Ziad actually wanted to do anything that the Boyds were talking about. Just because of their association, he was charged with conspiracy. Conspiracy is a favorite charge of the federal prosecutors and has been even before 9/11. So, because it's very vague, once you have a conspiracy, it's just an agreement to commit a crime, but you can have a conspiracy between two people, say Boyd and his sons, and then just rope other people into it with very little evidence. And it's really, that needs to be reformed too, so that you have to show more than just this slight bit of evidence, which allows people to be convicted by guilt by association. There's also sentencing things that we want to see reform in there's the terrorism enhancement in many of these sentences basically quadruples or triples. It's very complicated under the sentencing guidelines, but basically quadruples the sentence in many of these cases where they're not even terrorists anyway, but it gets used, and really there's no reason to have that at all. There's no need for it. If somebody's actually involved in violence, they're going to be facing a very harsh sentence anyway, and if they're not, then they shouldn't get the terrorism enhancement. So, another big one, which I had talked about, secret evidence. We need to reform it's called the Classified Evidence Procedures Act. In our case, in many other cases, even where the defense attorney gets a security clearance, I didn't get a security clearance, but another attorney who did the trial did, you still can't see the evidence. You still can't see the secret evidence that's given to the judge. And that is, I believe, a Sixth Amendment violation. The Sixth Amendment says you should be able to confront the evidence against you. And that should include the evidence given to the trial judge and the appeal judges, even if the jury doesn't see it. Because in our case, that judge used that evidence to tell the jury that there were good and valid reasons for targeting Yassin. There's all sorts of ways that secret evidence contaminates a case. And so we think if there's going to be secret evidence, it needs to be given to the defense attorneys. And that just seems really basic, but it's not happening.
It's so basic. Again, the word outrageous comes to mind to think of a system in which secret evidence can be actually kept from the defense attorney, and to call that a justice system seems like just a terrible misnomer. It is just mind-boggling how this has developed, and that really leads me to the question. I certainly agree with you that all of these reforms need to happen, but do you believe that at this point mere political advocacy is going to accomplish that, given the fact that we've actually arrived at this point through the regular machinations of the American government status quo?
Well, I think there has to be a lot more people that care about this, and I think that the Snowden revelations helped with that, in that people started seeing that maybe they needed to be a little more concerned about what the government was doing with this surveillance. And maybe they couldn't just trust what the government said about really anything to do with these, with surveillance or national security. So hopefully more people will be concerned about these things. One of our recommendations was already implemented, actually. One of our recommendations was having to do with the false statements prosecutions, where the FBI would charge people based on unrecorded interrogations, and then they had two FBI agents there. They would take notes, and then later, if they decided that the person had been dishonest, they would charge them with making a false statement, because it's illegal to lie to federal law enforcement. And so many people got those charges. About 20% of these cases that we analyzed had these false statements charges. Sometimes they could get very harsh sentences, because even though it's supposed to be a minor charge, they would slap the terrorism enhancement on it and give people pretty long sentences. And they would also use these charges to get plea deals when they didn't even have enough evidence to get these unfair convictions. They would say, well, look, we got this false statements charge. If you just plead guilty, we'll give you 5 years instead of 10 years. And they've done that a lot. So recently, probably not as a result of our report, but recently the FBI did decide to finally record these interrogations, at least. So it can still be a problem, but at least they won't be able to just make up whatever was said.
Exactly.
That was one of our recommendations.
Small step forward, but a step forward nonetheless. I suppose it's a step in the right direction. And a small note of victory, I guess, which we can at least look towards as possible model for how to proceed forward with this. Well, it is such a mind-boggling thing to contemplate the way the basic tenets of justice have been desecrated in this age of the war on terror. And of course, not just in the United States, in many places around the world. So I think it's something that really behooves us all to learn more about, in the way that this legal battle is happening. And perhaps it's particularly ironic that we're sitting here on the 4th of July, on Independence Day, talking about the way the American justice system has devolved to the point that it's in, to the point where I'm sure we could power a small city by just putting a generator in the graves of the founding fathers, thinking about the ideas that they would have had about the way the justice system has devolved. All right, Kathy Manley, just a very important study, and I hope people will go and download it. Again, the link will be in the show notes for this interview, but perhaps you can recommend any other websites or sites related to Project Salaam or the work that you do.
Well, the National Coalition to Protect Civil Freedoms website is www.civilfreedoms.org. That's another one. Also, there's the ACLU. There's a group called No Separate Justice that's been doing similar work to what we're doing, and they have noseparatejustice.org, I believe. And there's a lot of links to other groups from there, and we do hope that more and more people will get involved.
Well, I echo that that hope, and maybe this conversation will be one more small step in the right direction. Well, Kathy Manley, I do thank you for your time today, and I very much hope that this report gets even more widely read. So thank you for taking the time to put it together.
Thank you.